My name's Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I think many of you know that Tuesday Evenings is an ongoing lecture series. We've had quite a few up to date, and then we have a few more until April 8th this spring. So I invite you to come back next week and the following weeks for the Tuesday Evenings. Tonight, we continue the spring 2014 series with Lucy Ives and Alexander Prevan of Triple Canopy. Lucy Ives has a BA from Harvard, an MFA from the Iowa Writers Workshop, and is completing a PhD in comparative literature at NYU. She is a writer and a poet, among other things. Her first collection, the book-length poem Anamnesis from 2009, won the Slope Editions Book Prize. Last year, she authored the brief novel 90s and published a poetry and essay collection, Orange Roses. Alexander has a BA from Brown University. He is contributing editor to Bedouin, a magazine of the arts and culture of the Middle East. His writing on digital culture, aesthetics, literature, and politics has appeared in The Nation, The Believer, N Plus One, Book Forum, Art Forum, and Freeze, among other publications. And he is a fellow at the Vera List Center for Art and Politics at the New School for the 2013-2015 term. There's much more I could tell you about these individuals, and obviously they are active in their own right, but Lucy and Alex are here tonight as editors of Triple Canopy, a magazine and editorial collective since 2007, based in New York, I believe still in Los Angeles and Berlin. Triple Canopy is an innovative magazine that has advanced a model for publication that encompasses digital works of art and literature, public conversations, exhibitions, and books, a model that hinges on the development of publishing systems that incorporate networked forms of production and circulation. They work closely with artists, writers, technologists, and designers to produce projects that demand considered reading and viewing. Last summer, as part of the MoMA PS1 Exhibition Expo 1 New York, they organized Speculations, in parentheses, The Future Blank, which is was an installation and 50-day series of programs in which artists, writers, technologists, economists, academics, activists, economists. I really should edit my intro. Were invited to speculate about the future. Unfortunately, I didn't get to experience that personally, but it looked really interesting from my perspective online. Triple Canopy's resistance to the atomization of culture and their efforts to enrich the public sphere through sustained inquiry and creative research thrills me and makes me want to know more, to do whatever is within my means to support them and to spread the word, which is why I extended an invitation for them to be here tonight. Many of you will recall that Alex was here for the Tuesday Evenings a year ago, a short turnaround even for me. I kind of give myself a five-year limit, but I made an exception for Triple Canopy. He was then a part of a panel, a really, really good panel. Some of you were here for that, on different approaches to art publications with Pastelogram and Cabinet magazines. So I felt justified in asking him and Lucy for this Tuesday evening presentation, specifically on Triple Canopy, especially when I learned, much to my excitement, that Triple Canopy was selected for this year's Whitney Biennial. Given my admiration for Triple Canopy, I wasn't surprised, but I was curious about the inclusion of a magazine in the Whitney Biennial and how Triple Canopy would respond. So with the Whitney Biennial having just opened this past week and very much in the news, I feel that tonight's presentation is incredibly pertinent and absolutely justified as Lucy and Alex present Pointing Machines, the magazine's project for the 2014 Whitney Biennial. So please join me in welcoming Lucy Ives and Alexander Prevay.
He says yes. Oh, hey, that is definitely amplified. Well, I was about to say thank you, Terry, for such a kind introduction, and we are very, very happy and excited to be here and to share with you a little bit about our work as a magazine and also as a collective artist participating in this year's biennial at the Whitney. The first thing that we wanted to do was give you some idea of what we mean when we describe ourselves as a magazine, because as you may be aware, we do not publish a print magazine in so many words. And most of our activities can be discovered online by means of
the... If you have internet access.
Yes, if you have internet access.
Otherwise, look at the server not found message.
Yeah, trust us on this one. So when we say magazine, we are thinking of this term in a slightly expanded sense. And we want to be able to include all of the activities that we consider important for a lively, interesting, and exciting arts practice. So this would be in the field of literature, in the field of visual art, in performance, and also in critical work as well. I'm just wondering if I should wait here for the site to come up so that I could say something about it. But we have a physical space in Greenpoint in Brooklyn where we host readings and conversations and performances. And these events are advertised on our site and also find their way back to the site once they've taken place in the form of podcasts and other kinds of documentation. And we consider these performances pieces that are part of an issue of the magazine. So just because they're happening in space and in time, we don't consider them as separate from or distinct from the magazine. And the same is true of projects that we might do in print that might take the form of a pamphlet or a book. We also consider these kinds of activities as pieces that could be included in the magazine. And we also think about our installation in the biennial this year as a piece that is part of a magazine that we'll publish. And maybe Alex will say a little bit about what it means to us to publish an issue of the magazine, taking into account this idea of a kind of expanded definition of the magazine.
Yeah. Okay. So I can just say that Triple Canopy is basically... We've defined it as a magazine, and yet there are all of these different activities which we count as publication that are included in that. As Terry mentioned, we produce public programs, print editions, we produce technology, and we produce books. We often author things ourselves, and we often are editors of projects by other people. And so basically we conceive of publication as a space in which all of these things productively commingle, and we are particularly attuned to the uses of technology that enable that kind of activity and enable us to elucidate relationships between activities that may happen online or in real life or meet space, as people tend to say. And so our publishing platform is basically the hub for all these different activities. It provides an opportunity for us to communicate the importance of the relationships between texts that are published and conversations in Greenpoint and so on. One thing that digital publishing can do, which books cannot really, is combine recorded media and textual media. And so that is like the fundamental purpose of our publishing platform, is to create experiences that combine these media, and then like the greater purpose of the publication would be to basically like to take sites and experiences that are not often associated with publication, and to basically annex them and speak of them and treat them as sites of publication. And as a result, like those media change, and also one's notion of what publication means changes. So Lucy is scrolling through some pages on the newest iteration of our publishing platform, which we launched a few months ago. I think maybe it's important to say as a point of transition that like Triple Canopy often operates as an editorial collective, and yet primarily what we, perhaps the most significant activity we undertake is to work with artists and writers to very meticulously over long periods of time develop works that they can publish online or present in public. And yet we've worked collectively over the last year to author this publishing platform. And so each issue that we publish, the issue being the primary form of organization for our work, is in part authored by us, in part edited by us, in part authored by the writers and artists and researchers we work with. And so I think Pointing Machines is exemplary in its treatment of authorship. So maybe we can talk about that now.
Sure, that sounds good.
Okay. Do you want to switch back to the slideshow?
I'm not exactly sure how to do that. I'm a little nervous about making an error. Do you want to come in?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, great. Yeah, we were going to stand up and sit down a lot. That was part of our plan, so it's good that's working out. So very excited to show you these images. This is our installation currently in the Whitney right now, and the title of this installation is Pointing Machines. Pointing Machines is also the title of an issue of the magazine that will be published over the next 5 or 6 months. The issue of the magazine concerns technical and artistic reproduction, both in a historical context and in a more contemporary sense. And in this issue of the magazine, we're very interested in the ways in which the difference between objects, physical objects, and entities and information is increasingly becoming collapsed, and the ways in which things and information are valued are coming to seem, if not synonymous, then uncannily similar. So this is the general subject of the issue of the magazine, and our installation represents a kind of test case or case study within this broader rubric that we'd like to explore during the course of the period of time in which this issue will be published. So here you're looking at different images that are included in the installation. Among them, paintings from the 18th and 19th century, and also an 18th century piece of furniture, which is a wash basin stand, a wash basin that you would use to wash your face with. And as you can see, these artworks and furniture have been reproduced in various ways, and some of them are reproduced as different kinds of images, some as objects.
So maybe I'll just briefly say what a pointing machine is. This is an image of one kind of pointing machine. Not all pointing machines look the same, but they do act the same. It was a tool developed, I think There's some debate about this, but it was perfected in the 18th century to copy sculptures using a system of rods and needles, which basically measures the original and maps it onto a block of stone or wood, and then indicates. So a sculptor or a copyist would make points and then carve according to those points, and it's basically an effective way of copying a physical object. So, I mean, part of what I should say also that each issue is initiated by the editors and is a long-term project, is carried out over a period of 6 months or a year, and emerges from this collective research process, and then we invite writers and artists to contribute over time. So this seemed to us, this specific project seemed to us an interesting way to combine our investigations into the history of sculptural reproduction, going back to the proliferation of copies of ancient Greek sculpture by the ancient Romans after the Romans took over, which employed new technologies of reproduction and were also widely viewed as status markers for the emergent Roman elite. And so that kind of sculptural copying, of course, long precedes the copying of images. And, of course, scribes have copied texts for thousands and thousands of years. But sculptural copying especially seemed to us a very compelling precedent, since the aim is to replicate an object, but of course the replica is never the same as the original, regardless of how formally equivalent they may seem. And there are other precedents in publishing, especially in the 17th and 18th century in the U.S. and Europe, when especially in the U.S., the copying of texts by publishers, which was unauthorized, was viewed as essential to the development of an American culture, and so in general, copying during that period was viewed as a piece with the Enlightenment and with Enlightenment values, and not just in terms of publishing and like intellectual goods, but also in terms of inventions. And so there's this one publisher named Matthew Carey who published a magazine called The American Museum, which almost exclusively printed without authorization, reprinted texts from European magazines and books in America. And he actually advocated for what he called the American system, which was the widespread distribution of copies of European texts and of European inventions, and also he advocated for importing the inventors of European machines, and then they would be distributed throughout the country via a network of canals that the government would create, which is a kind of proto-internet. And so, I mean, there are many examples, which we can talk about later, in which copying and reproduction and replication are viewed as essential to the development of a national identity. And so because of this, the pointing machine seemed like a particularly apt point of reference.
Yes, so I also want to just call your attention to, I mean, we don't obviously have the installation here with us, but the way in which these images, these different kinds of images look together. And I want to explain also that the small rectangles that you see on the wall are light boxes. And there are photographs in there that are from a newspaper archive that we source that are being used as a space to keep clippings that are related to those images. And you can see both sides of the photographs because they're illuminated. And you see also another photograph, a larger photograph that we've seen before, that's printed. And then there's a wall vinyl there. And one of the goals of this installation is to ask the viewer to make these kinds of comparisons and to compare the quality of these different kinds of reproductions and the experience of seeing them and what kinds of information they give to you, and to try to think a little bit about what kind of information we can get from that comparison itself. Often we think of reproduction as an occasion on which an original loses its value or its aura or it's something special about it. And one of the arguments that we want to make with this installation is that reproduction does not necessarily entail loss, but might produce a kind of gain or knowledge. Mm-hmm.
And that each instance of reproduction has its own particular qualities, such that to speak of an original is in many situations somewhat absurd. And we say that in saying that we point to this rich history of reproduction in which the distinction between an original and a copy was not so clear, and the original and the copy were not assigned widely divergent values. So that seems to be, this hierarchy is in many cases very particular to the late 20th century. In art, it has to do with the development of connoisseurship in museum settings in the early 20th century, especially. So another relevant instance of reproduction is plaster cast collections, which were a feature of American and Western European and American and Western European museums primarily, but also some museums elsewhere. And for pedagogical purposes, but also just for the purposes of general display, museums would often have workshops where they would make plaster cast copies of ancient sculpture. And these were not viewed to be significantly less valuable or interesting than the originals. And in fact, many people argued that they had certain formal qualities that were more compelling or that emphasized the form and the technique of the sculptor in a way that the originals did not. Also, many of the originals were lost, and so no one could quite say how the various copies differed and how they pointed or did not point to the qualities of the original. And this is a sort of a strange Victorian tool used to amplify the contours of a sculpture for analysis in relation to an original. So this also sort of illustrates the various modes of reproduction of a particular sculpture.
We've been having a conversation about how to pronounce this unfortunate man's name. The Laocoon?
Yeah, we'll say the Laocoon.
Yeah.
This is William Blake's print depicting the sculpture in which he derided the many copies of it, and generally derided copying as antithetical to the values of the Romantic artist. This is obviously a digital image, feels very very 90s. This is the various kind of Laocoon goods you can get on Zazzle today, and this is the transformation back into object from data.
Yes, most valuable example. Okay, so I said a moment ago that our installation was functioning as a kind of case study of a particular collection or a particular series of images. And the images that you've seen, this is a black and white reproduction. As I mentioned, this is from an archive from the Baltimore Sun's archive, and it's a photograph of the painting that was to be reproduced in the newspaper. It's something that we purchased on eBay. This image and many of the other images that you see in the installation are taken from a collection of folk art, of primitive paintings, as they were called in the mid-20th century, or naive paintings, however you like to term them. Again, this is the back of one of the archival photographs from the Baltimore Sun. This collection of folk art was amassed by two people, Edgar William and Bernice Chrysler Garbisch, two Americans who began collecting in the 1950s in order to decorate a home that they had in Maryland. And we were interested in their collection, which contains 18th and 19th century furniture as well as paintings and works on paper, because it has a special relationship with the Whitney, not only because the Whitney was the first museum in New York to have a formal show of folk art in 1924. The Whitney Studio Club had a small, somewhat cobbled together with different artists' contributions, show of paintings from the 19th century, but also because the Garbisches had donated a collection of 25 paintings to the Whitney. And these paintings were deaccessioned. They were sold at auction. However, two paintings did not sell, and so they remain within the Whitney's collection. However, they're not listed in the Whitney's catalog, and in fact, they just exist in storage, and there's no documentation of them. And so we were interested in what happens to images like these when they seem to fall out of circulation and seem to be something that a museum no longer values or a public no longer values. Where do we find these images? What do they look like now? What are their qualities? How are they being reproduced? And how can we ourselves reproduce them? Mm-hmm. Here you can see this is a spread from Vogue in 1959 that shows you the inside of the Garbisch's house that was on the Maryland shore. And this image of the Native American chief that you've seen reproduced a couple of times so far in the slideshow, there it is hanging on the wall. And this is a major way that the Garbisch's collection circulated during their lifetimes, was within a fashion magazine like this or in home decorating magazines. And so you would see these paintings reproduced in a kind of period room, slightly different from the period room that you think of in a museum. But.
And can I just jump in and say that the Garbisches also had a collection of modern European painting, but they purchased a house in Maryland called Pockety Farms, and this was a typical American vacation home, would you call it? Or
yeah, it was a hunting lodge.
A hunting lodge,
was
okay.
The way that it's been described.
And so they began collecting American folk art and colonial era furniture because they wanted the proper decoration for this home. And so, you know, we sort of began not with the production of these objects, but with their the point at which they came together as part of a collection. And so that was, you know, originally it served a primarily decorative purpose as an expression of as an expression of America or Americana.
Right.
And
of a certain kind of taste and domestic idea of domestic life.
These works were exhibited early on, shortly after the Garbisches began to collect them. But at the same time, they circulated in publications like Home Decorating and Vogue. So, and we were particularly interested in the way that these images circulate in various forms and formats, and how we could meaningfully continue to reproduce these images in a way that would work toward describing our current information environment. So it's maybe reaching to call the installation in this project a historical analogy for the digital environment, but we were looking for ways to describe these histories of circulation and the way in which images are collected, dispersed, exhibited, and so on, and attain or lose certain kinds of value and status as a way of understanding the environment that we live in now.
Right. And in so doing, we also began to become more interested in the images themselves and how they had been created as paintings originally in the 18th and 19th centuries. And the sorts of work that the Garbishes were interested in was often produced by a kind of painter who would have primarily been doing portraits, and doing portraits as a kind of service to people in a given town, locality, much in the way in which you might go to have your photograph taken a little bit later in the 19th century by the daguerreotypist. And these painters were referred to as limners, which is an interesting word you don't hear very much now. They were often
you'll start hearing it a lot, probably.
Yeah, maybe we can only hope it. They were often people who worked, also painting houses, painting carriages. They understood how to mix paints that would be stable and also resist the effects of weather. So they were skilled people, but often when they did a portrait for you, they would not sign it. So much of the work is anonymous. And we don't know who made the paintings. Within the installation, we have one painting which is dated as being from 1840. And I'm going to show you a large image of it now. This is the painting. It's just titled We Go for the Union. It's within the National Gallery's collection in Washington, D.C. And this museum received the lion's share of the Garbishes collection. They have really the best examples of this work. And we really liked this particular painting because it's very unusual in that it shows a limner in his workshop. So that's this figure in yellow here, who's sort of very elegantly depicted himself in like a yellow jacket, and he has a palette as well. All of the, trappings of his profession. And there are two other figures. There's a man who's grinding out blue paint, you can see, and then also another man who's assisting in the painting of this work here, which is actually a political banner for a rally that was going to take place, and for the Whig Party was a populist movement of the time, and so there would be these rallies in Philadelphia where people would gather in a parade ground and everybody would have one of these banners like this. So we thought that this image was particularly interesting because it shows how the labor of painting this banner was divided up between different people within the studio. So you have a man who's taking care of the technical side of producing the paint, and it's blue paint. And then there's also the figure of the limner. Here's a window. You can see the painting houses. There's the limner who's drawing the outlines. He's doing the fine work on this banner. And then there's the third figure who's painting in the broader strokes and to some extent hand replicating what the limner is doing. Also, what's very interesting about this image is that it shows this image of George Washington, which I'm sure you are all very familiar with. Here you can see the famous Stuart painting, and we also have an engraving of it. So you can see that painting was much reproduced in popular engravings. I believe this is from 1852. So when a limner went to make an image for a painting, he was often depending on images like these, print images, in order to establish a familiar likeness for his own work, to lend legitimacy to it, but also to participate in a certain culture of representation that was being developed at that time in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And we're very interested in the relationship between this culture of representation and this style or genre of painting and printing and the graphic arts and the kinds of reproduction and reproducibility entailed in that work.
And yeah, and it's worth saying also that some of the portraits we showed earlier also hinge on reproduction of often of commercial imagery. So at times, limners and other commercial artists would take images from newspapers, magazines, products, posters, and so on, and incorporate them into their art, such that they would. I mean, they might travel, advertising their craft as portraitists, and they would basically paint the paintings in advance, and the bodies might be taken from popular sources, and they would basically add your face to the ready-made image, and. And so, I mean, there's a lot to be said about the importance of the replication of certain images in developing and their circulation and their reproduction in various forms in the development of a sense of national identity, and that applies to publishing as well. But maybe we can talk about that later.
Before we move on, I just want to... This kind of image is really fascinating to me. This is a daguerreotype, probably made maybe two decades after that painting that we were looking at. And you can see here the way in which the role of the limner, the painter, began to be superseded by the daguerreotypist. And what's fascinating here is you see this woman is holding a painting, and this is actually a painting that's in the Garbage collection. It's part of the Garbage collection, very strangely. So here's a painting of a child that was done by an itinerant anonymous portraitist, and here she's had it commemorated again within this photograph. So you can see a little bit here about how people were thinking about reproduction at this particular time, when we don't normally think of people having much access to technical forms of reproduction. But in fact, it seems to have been very much part of the culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I mean, as Lucy pointed out in her reading of this We Go for the Union painting, we're interested in a few different kinds of reproduction, specifically technical reproduction, hand reproduction, and reproduction having to do with the way in which an object is displayed or published and so disseminated. And so just to jump forward many, many years... In terms of the implications for us today, we were interested in how the tools, like how we might use the tools for producing and reproducing, we were interested in the relationships between those forms of reproduction and digital imaging specifically, and how these observations about replication and reproduction in early American visual culture might relate to contemporary questions about intellectual property, authorship, and the status of certain kinds of images, especially images constructed from 3D scans, and how photography is being redefined in relation to those images, and especially within a legal framework. So, you can make certain correspondences between 3D scanning and printing and the tools of reproduction that we've discussed in the past. These are tools in the workshop of Frank Rhodes, who is a woodworker who we'll talk about in a sec. But basically, to give you the short of it, 3D printing has the potential to produce a like something of a crisis in like our notions of authorship around around photography. There's one instructive case called Meshworks versus Toyota, in which a company called Meshworks was commissioned by Toyota to make a 3D scan of a car in order to produce an advertisement, because it would be cheaper and easier to just play around with that 3D scan through animation rather than filming a bunch of different scenes. And so they contracted for one-time use of this scan, but then Toyota continued to use it repeatedly, and Meshworks sued, claiming that the image they had produced of the car was copyrighted, basically. And so, of course, for an image to be copyrighted, it has to have some originality, but you know, photography is often automatically deemed to be original because the individual frames a picture and decides when to press the button. Of course, that, you know, that's like a pretty antiquated notion of originality and doesn't take into account the you know, the total lack of skill required to take digital photographs. But nevertheless, you know, you don't want to make judges become art historians or theorists, and so they've basically stuck with that antiquated standard. So Meshworks argued that in this case, they were not just reproducing a fact that existed in the world. They said that 90%, like 10% of the image was the reproduction of this fact being the car, and 10% or 90% of the image was what they called sculpting the data. And you know, that means taking all of these data points and turning it into a legible image. And you know, they argued that the image they had produced was very different from the car itself. And they lost this case because the judge ruled that it was basically just a copy of the car, except in 3D form. And so there are great implications for this kind of ruling as they might be applied to photography. You know, this judge's ruling basically suggests that any drawing of a car or of a body or of any other fact in the world cannot be copyrighted by whomever produced it, whether artist, fine artist, or commercial artist. And so, you know, part of what has been on our mind as we've been working on this project is the potential for the confusion of these various modes of the production or reproduction of images, the effect that they might have on authorship and therefore the status and value of these images.
And we've tried to express that both with the photographs like this that you've seen, which was taken in the studio of Frank Rhodes, who's a woodworker and also coincidentally, or not so coincidentally, the grandson of the Garbishes who amassed this collection. And he became interested in early American furniture and this type of artwork through their collection, mm-hmm. and has continued to educate himself about that and to become world-class woodworker and furniture restorer and now reproducer.
Yeah, and I just say that he specializes in the restoration and reproduction of colonial era and antique furniture.
Yeah.
And so this is his workshop. He's also a kind of unofficial family archivist. The family has no foundation or anything. They got rid of everything after the Edgar or the Colonel and Bernice Chrysler Garbish died. And so he probably has the largest collection of publications, mm-hmm. and postcards and posters and other ephemera related to the collection. And they are primarily stored in his woodshop Chestertown, Maryland, which we visited, and that's where we took these photographs.
Yeah. And we visited together and took these photographs together. And so you can see once again this image that we've seen before. That's a poster that's actually on the wall in his studio. So let's go to the basin stand. Okay, so this is an image of an 18th century basin stand, which is in the collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art and was at one time owned by the Garbishes and was in their house in Maryland. This is a reproduction by Frank Rhodes of that basin stand, which he made for us over a period of 4 months this winter. And let's go to the next slide. Here you can see on your right, this is the original. I'm going to put scare quotes around that, and Alex will tell you why I'm doing that in a moment. This is the original basin stand from the Met. In the middle, we see a 3D print of the wash basin stand, which was made for us at labs at New York University. And then on the left, this is the unfinished version of the hand reproduction that was made for us by Frank. And we were very interested in our installation to show what we considered three characters or kinds of reproduction. So, of course, you have the, again, original, I'm putting scare quotes around it, but we're essentially reproducing this stand by bringing it out into a public space, into the museum, and sort of drawing a circle around it and calling attention to it. By exhibiting it, in a sense, we're reproducing it. We're adding a kind of exhibition value.
And also inevitably reproducing it through publication, both the Whitney's publications and the publications of various people who write about and photograph the exhibition.
Yeah. And then in the center, we have the technical reproduction, this three-dimensional image that's been produced for us for the gallery space. And then finally, the hand reproduction, which is in fact physically far more accurate to the actual 18th century wash basin stand than the 3D print, which is another interesting fact. And thinking back a little bit to the painting from the National Gallery, which showed the Limner's studio, we're interested in the parallels between the embodiments of different kind of labor that we see here and in those three figures as well, and different kinds of activities that would be associated with these different types of reproduction and different kinds of roles on the part of an artist or a writer or whoever it might be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think we also found this particular object compelling because it is beautiful and somewhat confounding. You would potentially mistake it for an umbrella stand. Or a hat stand, or
a stool, as one reviewer did.
A stool that you could, yeah.
Have trouble sitting on that.
Yeah. but also, so this object, as you might have seen in an earlier photograph we showed, was in a hallway in the Garbish's house in Pocketty Farms, and so throughout the years it has been treated more or less as an art object, but it doesn't technically have an author. It's believed to be produced by John Townsend, who is a famous Newport furniture maker in the 1760s through the 1780s. Its value, we'll just say that its value to us is kind of inscrutable when compared to how the value of certain art objects appreciate over time as they are incorporated into collections, published, and exhibited. There's no real sense of how many of these pieces of furniture John Townsend or whomever he worked with made. So it's not necessarily original. Probably he wouldn't have made only one thing like this. And yet, as far as I know, there's no other John Townsend basin stand in an American museum. Yet no one's like desperately searching for all of the other basin stands. And so this has, over time, sort of come in and into and out of like various streams of circulation that have to do with modern art, contemporary art, and folk art, and yet its value to us is very difficult to assess, and it is, you know, still basically a useful object and a domestic object. And so one thing we were very interested in is how the value of this object, both the original and the copies, change as you reproduce them more or less as sculptures. So you can't, you know, of course you cannot use the original, you can't use the copies we made either, because they're technically artworks, and yet they're ultimately also works by craft. They're works of craft.
And you could probably put a basin on that and use it to wash your face in the morning. We would not prohibit that.
And I mean, it's worth saying also that the Met agreed to, for a fee, scan the original basin stand for us. And so we made the 3D printed object from the Met's scan. We had originally talked to them about distributing the scan for free so that others could reproduce the object themselves, and you know, those who have the technical abilities could modify the object as well and print it, and they could scale it down and print it on their own 3D printers, or it's very easy now to contract with 3D print shops. And the Met initially was enthusiastic about this idea, but then became very nervous about the value of the basin stand being diminished by the proliferation of degraded versions of it. They were also concerned that while they're not currently making trinkets that look like this basin stand, they wouldn't want other people to profit by making such trinkets. And so that's a very, you know, it was strange talking to them, because they were very excited about this project. They're very excited about the idea of reproducing this object and putting it out in the world in a very contemporary setting and defining it as contemporary through its reproductions. And yet, ultimately, they didn't feel like they could partake of that reproduction themselves as an institution. And at the same time, you have museums like the Rijksmuseum, which are making every object in their collection available to the public through high-res images and 3D prints and various other kinds of prints, which you can order for a reasonable fee from them. You can order details, you can order prints on any material, you can order various kinds of reproductions of three-dimensional objects. And so it's... I don't really have a conclusion, but it's very curious to us that these institutions take such divergent views of the value of their objects and how the institution can capitalize on that value. And this seems like a moment in which that extraordinary difference of opinion is especially problematic, and it's up to Triple Canopy to deal with it.
Indeed. And also just to say that we think that this type of work can also exemplify, or there's more of a reason for our enactment of this particular kind of an installation in the Whitney. In other words, it helps to demonstrate our own practice as publishers, as well as elucidating a kind of history and also a story about certain kinds of legal concerns, the way art objects and other kinds of objects and authorship are determined, valued. And so to talk just briefly and probably to conclude here, to say again a little bit more about how we conceive of publication and how we conceive of a practice of publication in what we term the expanded field, taking Rosalind Krauss's essay about sculpture in the expanded field, which discusses minimalist sculpture and earthworks. When we think about publication, obviously, we consider a 3D print like this and its display a form of publication, much as we were saying earlier, we consider a public program or a piece online or a book or a conversation about the relationship between these works an act of publication. And this is something that we value very highly as we try to think about how we can create dialogue between artists and other kinds of creative practitioners. And our installation is a way of creating a kind of it's a gallery of images, yes, but a kind of image of our own practice that people can walk into and look around and sort of wrap their minds around in that space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can say also that it was especially salient to me in looking at these reproductions that what we're asking people to do is look at these objects very closely. And you know, as we showed with the plaster casts and the various other reproductions of sculptures in which certain characteristics of the sculptures become all the more apparent as you examine them in relation to various versions or reproductions, that is the kind of work Triple Canopy does, is the production and reproduction of documents and texts and images in an environment that requests, if not demands, a great deal of attention on the part of the reader. And so, this isn't an exercise in reading objects, but it does ask the viewer to become a reader of texts in a certain way. And to perform a certain kind of comparative analysis, and yet, of course, everything in the installation is very pleasant to look at. And it, I'm making it sound much more strenuous than it actually is. We also talked earlier about the way in which circulation figures into the cultivation of a public, and in the case of folk art, a development of national identity. And so we're very interested in how the circulation of texts and how various publishing activities that occur within different spaces can contribute to the cultivation of a public around our own work, whether that happens at our space in Greenpoint or through a reading or at the Whitney through the presentation of these objects. And so also importantly for us, this has been a very challenging and rewarding process of figuring out how the kind of publication we do can be enacted in a museum context in a way that seems rich and rewarding and generous and also has some fidelity, but not too much fidelity.
Yeah, just enough.
Yeah. Oh, maybe we could end there, but I should also talk. I should mention Spencer's contribution.
Yes, that everyone heard as they were coming
yeah,
in.
So, yeah. So the sound piece you heard as you were coming in is actually included in the installation. It's a work that we did with a musician and artist named C. Spencer Yeh, and it is basically the soundtrack to a film about the garbage collection that we discovered at Frank Rhodes's wood shop. And it is the same, I think, 25-second bit of music subjected to many different transcoding processes. Audio codecs such as the MP3 or AIFF or I forget what the real-time format is. So, but basically that piece is a kind of history of the reproduction of sound through various formats, some of which are all about fidelity, like the absolute highest quality sound that can be produced without being like taking up an insane amount of hard drive space, and some of which are all about mobility, which is to say they are very small files and a lot of information is extracted from them, and yet they they're still tolerable to listen to, but they're made for the kind of sounds that that doesn't require like a high definition experience. And so those, of course, have changed. There are different formats for different kinds of experiences and different format. Like, of course, the MP3 is the definitive format for peer-to-peer file trading. But basically what that sound work does is perform a kind of history of audio encoding, which, and there are two separate loops. So quite often you have a very contemporary format and a historical format converging, and what you hear is the difference between the formats when a certain amount of like a high definition version and a version that has a lot of information extracted from it come together, which is a nice way of thinking about the installation in general, actually. And our timing is perfect. Yeah. That was exactly an hour.
So I think we will conclude our presentation here, but we would welcome any questions that you might have, particularly as we went through a great deal of material there. So please.
Okay, I'll start. This is kind of off the beaten path a little bit, but could you talk about what you think the relationship might be, or the differences or similarities between replica and translation, the concept of translation?
Sure. The replica, Alex used the word fidelity mm-hmm. earlier.
You could also say like lossiness.
Yeah, we could talk about that. But there's an ambition associated with replication that I think has a slightly different bent when it comes to translation, and obviously when we talk about translation, I'm drawn to because I'm a writer, I'm drawn to the process of taking writing text in one language and putting it into another language, and I guess that the old saw there, right, is that it's impossible, that you're never going to get the same meaning from two different languages. When we talk about replication, Alex used the word just now of lossiness. Obviously, even in the most perfect, pristine, careful, painstaking hand reproduction, like the basin stand that Frank Rhodes produced, there are kinds of information that are lost simply because it is not the same piece of wood, mm-hmm. right? And then there are all sorts of other contingencies that come into play that cause the stand to be non-identical, and we can think of what all of those are. But many of these are related to physicality and time. And translation seems to be a process that we have a different sort of intellectual relationship to, even, and we're much more willing to accept changes and value them, I think. It's just not... That process is one in which we simply are often simply impressed by the undertaking itself, and that is usually not the way that we relate to a replica. With a replica, we want to see the perfect thing. We want to see the identical thing. We want to be challenged by that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain amount of artistic license that is associated with translation, and I would say here we very specifically, when reproducing the basin stand, sought out technicians or people who work with certain crafts and challenge them to reproduce. I mean, we challenge them to replicate the original object, knowing that it was impossible, but also knowing that they would strive to do so to the greatest degree possible, given the tools they employ. And what was interesting to us is the inevitability of those differences and the way in which and the inevitability that those differences would be meaningful and interesting and aesthetically appealing, rather than seeming to be false.
You know, if something's lovingly translated, the person doing that translation has to get to know their source in a really kind of deep and meaningful way. And I wonder if the same thing doesn't happen when somebody replicates a physical object. And if there can be meaning found in those differences, in the inevitable differences, if new meaning can be found in that, the way it's found in a translation.
Yeah,
I think that's true. And I just want to say, I'm not sure if you saw, but in Frank, Frank, this is an image taken by Frank Rhodes himself. And you'll notice here that he photographed the wash basin stand in this particular staged environment, you know, as if it's a portrait of a person. And so for him, this basin stand obviously has a certain kind of value, a kind of, I mean, almost like a kind of aura, like a portrait would have.
He grew up with this object in certain ways, so he's not just reproducing the object, he's reproducing, I mean, he's bringing to bear his memories of the object, his relationships with the work and with his family. And so, you know, to me, like, this is a really enchanting object because it brings to bear all of these familial and historical and social relationships that, perhaps those existed in relation to the original, but having something in a museum for a certain period of time and treating it as a rarefied object sort of, you know, makes it so you can't experience it in that way anymore. And so this right now, at least as we can all tell these stories about it, has a certain meaning that that is really extraordinary and singular.
Yes.
Well, it seems to me that this is kind of interesting from the perspective, say, of modern, postmodern approach to art, incorporating the Aristotelian perspective that, like, any given work of art is actually the embodiment of a particular innate quality or attribute and essence, if you will. Okay, that is what the work of art is about, and kind of conveys an abstract universal as opposed to a concrete particular, and therefore it doesn't really matter whether it's copied, it doesn't really matter whether a particular person claims authorship where the authorship is attributed to him. As a matter of fact, in Aristotle's time, that concept of authorship as we identify with it now was kind of an unknown concept. I wonder, on reflection, do you think that that's kind of what you're moving towards in the work that you're doing here?
Well, I want to come back at one thing that you said, and you're paraphrasing. I think you're sort of extrapolating from Aristotle and also paraphrasing and saying it doesn't matter if it's a copy. And I think when we say that, or when we say, oh, it's just a copy, for example, we want to take that phrase, oh, it's just a copy, and change the way it works. And so it's not a matter of saying, we want to bring back, you know, your Shakespeare. We want to bring back your heroic author, but that we want to consider all of the contingencies that are associated with this work and explore and describe more and have a sense, a greater sense of the actual presence of information and significance associated with copying itself. So in that sense, I think what I'm trying to say is yes, but it's not a return. We want to push things in a slightly different direction, if that makes sense.
I have to say you guys are a great setup because in a couple of weeks we have Kenneth Goldsmith here. Do you know Kenneth Goldsmith's work? Which I don't know how many of you have looked ahead or happen to already know about his work, but it's very much about copying and the value of copying.
Yeah, he's living it.
Yes.
We're just interlopers. He's living it. We're just interlopers.
In regards to the value of a copy or not, I'm reminded that Venus de Milo is supposed to be a copy of the original Greek original, which has been lost. Would we value that original more because it's more beautiful, or would be more likely to value because it was the original, but the one that's presently there in the Louvre is more of value to us, it's just beautiful?
Yes. Well, we have one of them.
Yeah. I mean, it's so hard to say because...
Well, you know, in so many instances, these Roman-era sculptures have been analyzed really seriously to discern when they were made and whether or not they were copies of pre-existing sculptures. But, you know, So we know that they provide us with certain information about something that no longer exists, and so that information is very difficult, if not impossible, to interpret. We just know that, and we have the information about the original, but we don't have the original, so we can't tell whether that information actually maps onto the original in a meaningful way. It's strange. You know, art historians have valued those copies specifically in different ways over time, and I think there was a period in maybe the late 1800s, early 1900s, when art historians really turned against those copies and decided that they were not interesting, that they had no value, that they were entirely derivative. And museums, you know, hid them away in storage, and you know, that was a very particular period in which all of a sudden authorship was valued extremely highly, and you know, within a museum setting that is of course still true, but there was a kind of, you know, the tide shifted, I think, throughout the early 20th century, and certain art historians mounted arguments in favor, or that restored a certain amount of value to those copies, and in many cases argued that they were not in fact copies, or they were copies of copies of copies, and so it didn't really matter at all.
Was talking about the earth art movement as being more of a photography movement than anything, because, you know, how many people have actually traveled to these sites for these earthworks and been terribly disappointed because they're not nearly as epic as the photograph.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's one thing we, you know, we could talk about for a long time, but didn't talk about so much is the relationship between photography and documentation and publication when assessing the value of work, but also when, you know, determining what the experience of a work is, and that is like essential to understanding earthworks because, you know, those are essentially staged photographs for most people, so much of the the expectation around the experience of those works and the aura that they produce is about how they were photographed. Yeah.
Guys, that was so good. I think we're kind of out of time, but thank you so much.
Thank you. I forgot to say at the beginning, thank you so much to Terry for inviting us. It's really nice to be here twice. I feel like this is becoming a second home. Yeah, I wish we could come back to see some of the other talks. Yeah. Thanks everyone for coming. Yeah.